Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
And it promotes economic development in Native communities while helping to fulfill the federal trust responsibility.
Senator Lisa Murkowski defends a federal program heavily used by Alaska Native corporations. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, February 10th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, residents who stayed behind in Quigilingok contemplate the future of home.
If we eventually move to a new site, it won't be quick. But in a way, we'll bring quick with us.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
The PFD application is open. Just a small amount of your PFD will help share local news and stories about Alaskans with Alaskans across this great state when you choose Alaska Public Media through Pick, Click, Give.
Tribal leaders from across the country spoke out today at a U.S. Senate hearing against possible changes within the Small Business Administration program that supports Native entities, including Alaska Native corporations and tribes. The Alaska Desk's Aliona Nyden reports.
The 8A Business Development Program provides federal contracting opportunities to socially disadvantaged individuals or tribes. It is widely used by Alaska Native corporations, especially when competing for Department of Defense contracts. U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski co-led the oversight hearing focused on the program. She says it benefits both the U.S. government and indigenous communities in Alaska and across the country.
It delivers mission-critical work for civilian and defense agencies, and it promotes economic development in Native communities while helping to fulfill the federal trust responsibility.
But over the past year, the Federal Small Business Administration and other agencies have launched audits into the program and announced a sweeping suspension of companies participating in it. U.S. Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth also announced on social media last month that his department would be, quote, taking a sledgehammer, end quote, to the 8A program. He called it a diversity, equity, and inclusion initiative. Murkowski says that Native-owned businesses participate in the program because Congress recognized the government's trust and treaty obligations to Native communities, which is not a racial relationship, but a political one.
That was not based on race. It was not based on DEI.
2 of 4 testifiers at the hearing represented Alaska Native corporations. Catherine Carlton is Inupiat from Cordova and is the president of Chugach Alaska Corporation. She told committee members that her organization has participated in the program for decades and has benefited from its economic opportunities.
For us, it provided the pathway to recover from the devastating Exxon Valdez oil spill in our region and rebuild our business.
Carlton says revenue from 8A contracts helps Chugach pay dividends to shareholders. It also funds jobs and creates economic opportunities in villages where it's desperately needed. Another Alaska Native leader, Polly Watson, also testified at the hearing. Watson is from village of Perryville on the Alaska Peninsula. She's now Vice President of Operations at Bristol Bay Native Corporation and says her organization has several businesses participating in the 8A program.
In areas such as logistics, construction, facility support, information technology, professional services, and mission support.
Watson says the corporation reinvests the revenue it receives through government contracts back into community. She says that one example is a partnership with the State Division of Motor Vehicles to deliver mobile DMV services.
Through this program, we have worked with the DMV to bring real ID and driver's license services to 7 villages in the Bristol Bay region, serving 544 rural residents.
During the hearing, Murkowski also acknowledged that Alaska Native corporations recently faced pushback from shareholders for some business, like participating in contracts from the Department of Homeland Security for detention and deportation activities. Tribal leaders and senators from Nevada, Oklahoma, Montana, and Hawaii all spoke in support of the Native participation in the 8A program. Murkowski says the committee will continue to take questions for the record for a couple weeks. In Anchorage, I am Aliona Nyden.
When the western Alaska village of Quigilingok was hit by the remnants of Typhoon Halong, almost everyone was evacuated by helicopter and plane. But some never left, and KYUK's Samantha Watson reports, despite the challenges of a community in repair, more are returning.
The calendars in the Quigilingok school all say it's October. One classroom whiteboard has the date written neatly in green dry erase marker, October 10th, 2025, a Friday. On Saturday, many from the village sheltered in the school as the remnants of Typhoon Halong approached. By the end of the week, nearly all 400 residents had been airlifted out of the community.
It made me think of like the rapture.
Daryl John introduces himself first as a lifelong community member of Quigilingok, then as the counselor and community advocate for the school. He says he chose to stay behind to help as the rest of the village was evacuated to Bethel. He was one of seven people. What was left of the town had changed. The tundra terrain was flooded. Homes had been lifted and rearranged by the storm or had floated away entirely. John had been living in Quigilingok since before running water and electricity arrived around the 1980s. Cut off from utilities, he says he had to reintroduce himself to forgotten chores of daily life, like hauling ice for household water. In the early days after the storm, John says Quigilingok was silent.
No dogs barking, no four wheels passing. Like the night I went to bed, I couldn't sleep because it was too quiet.
Now, in the months since the storm, some of those sounds have been returning to the village. Contractors arrived in the fall to begin the state-funded cleanup, including Quig residents who wanted to help rebuild. A small number of other community members returned to houses that sustained minimal damage. In the new year, 15 kids came back to Quigilingok with their families. Most of them are homeschooling. Without daily classes, the school has become a hub for life in the repairing village, including daily meals for anyone who's still here. Mark Adkins is an executive chef with Arctic Catering. He runs the kitchen.
Everyone comes through here. Everyone in the village, this is where they come.
Lunch today is a spread of salmon chowder, corn dogs, chicken tenders, and a salad bar. Workers sit down to eat alongside parents, elders, and children. The contractor sneaks a bowl of chowder to a lone dog outside. Three times a day, anyone in town can gather here for a meal.
It just helps the community repair itself, you know, feel more at home again that someone's here looking after them, you know, a little more ease.
But outside of the school, life in Quigilingok has a new set of challenges. There are no health aides in town. And even as homes are restored, a lot of access equipment like snow machines and subsistence tools were swept away. The Quigilingok tribe issued guidance against residents returning to the village. Gavin Phillip is the administrator for the tribe of Quigilingok. He was evacuated to Bethel, where he's remained since the storm. He says Quig residents that wished to return had to agree to be entirely self-sufficient.
Even though we rebuild or the recovery efforts that are happening, I don't know come the spring or summer, I don't know if they will return.
Part of that is logistical, but Phillip says it has more to do with the emotional weight of returning to Quigilingok after living through the storm.
There's hesitancy up among the tribal members to return due to the trauma.
But for the ones who have come back, or Daryl John and the other six who stayed, life is persisting. The children laugh and call out as they play in the school gymnasium after lunch. I ask John if it still feels like Quig here.
By heart, yes, it does feel like Quigilingok, and it always will stay as Quigilingok. But when I go towards the south end of the village, you know, it's that feeling of it's still Quigilingok kind of fades away because that portion of the community is wiped. It's gone.
In addition to helping, Daryl John says he wanted to stay because his identity as a tribal member is intrinsically entwined with Quiguilinguk. But he wants his children and grandchildren to live in a better place than what it's become, and without the fear of it happening again. He says most residents are united in wanting to relocate their village to higher ground.
Well, you know, if we eventually move to a new site, yeah, it won't be quick. But in a way, we'll bring Quig with us.
Until a relocation happens, Quig is in what's left of the village, and with residents displaced in Bethel and beyond. In Quiguilinguk, I'm Samantha Watson.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, with Valentine's Day around the corner, how can Alaskans increase their chances of finding love?
Going out and sitting and chit-chatting with your friends, that opens up your social circle. That means you could potentially meet more people.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
I'm Shelby Herbert, a reporter with the Alaska Desk. That's a joint reporting effort from Alaska Public Media and KUAC, where I work in Fairbanks, and other public radio stations in Anchorage, Haines, and the Aleutians. It allows us to connect you with the issues happening in communities all across the state. You can hear our stories during the morning news, Alaska News Nightly, or online at alaskapublic.org. The Alaska Desk is only possible with the support of grants and listeners like you. Thank you.
As breweries in Alaska adjust to a legal ruling that could allow them to have unlimited live shows, a different sort of industry is also celebrating: musicians. Until last month, breweries were limited to 4 live shows a year, and before 2024, they were banned from having them completely. Now, breweries can have unlimited live music performances. And as KTOO's Yvonne Crumry reports, the ruling comes right on time for musicians and businesses to start planning for Alaska Folk Fest in April.
Marion Call is a junior musician, and as executive director of Music Alaska, she's also spent the last few years organizing other musicians across the state to advocate for the industry. She said the recent Alaska Superior Court ruling opens doors for musicians and performers.
This regulation was ultimately a regulation about when and where musicians can work. It was essentially putting a limit on how often and in what locations we can do our job.
The ruling argued that the regulations that limited live shows at breweries suppressed free speech.
It makes sense for the government to regulate various industries, but the thing that was so difficult about this particular regulation was that they were not intending to regulate the music industry. They were intending to regulate the alcohol industry.
And Call says musicians are a force in Juneau. More performances in town don't create a zero-sum game economically. Call says Music Alaska researches the economic impacts of music in communities.
Generally, what we see is that more music breeds more economic growth without necessarily undermining other sectors. We come into a space where there was no economic activity and created kind of out of thin air.
If the ruling holds, this could open doors, financially and creatively, for musicians during the city's biggest music event of the year, Call says.
I think Folk Fest excites me the most because it's really an invitation, not just for everyone to come out and listen and enjoy, but also for everyone to play. And I can't wait to see people feeling free to play anywhere without worrying about it.
Avery Stewart is a guitarist, vocalist, and writer with the local band The Rain Dogs. While meeting with a bandmate at a cafe in Juneau, he says he thinks former limitations have dampened Juneau's creative spirit during Folk Fest.
I was just recalling, like, past Folk Fest, seeing signs on the walls of distilleries because they had to put up these signs like, do not play music here, which I thought was so silly.
He and band member Anna Mahanner said that impromptu jam sessions are an inherent part of the festival, and now there's no risk of businesses or musicians facing fines for them.
Instead, it's like, you know, you're interacting with one another by playing music, by jamming, by having it be maybe not a, like, high-profile thing, you know, but it's more casual.
It's like a communal experience rather than a performance.
Yeah.
It's just a sharing of music in its purest form.
Mahanner says she's excited to have more places to play in Juneau, and different venues to suit different kinds of shows. She says she wants to be able to play for broader audiences.
I think that our sound is evolving in a lot of different ways, and we're experimenting with playing in different places. Like, there's, you know, a certain energy that you bring to when you're playing at, like, a bar or a dive bar.
And a lot of the Rain Dog shows meet that energy, loud and rowdy. But Mahanner wants to play in quieter venues, too.
And then with the idea of there being kind of more listening room styles, it's like a little bit more intimate and you can be a little bit more personal with the crowd, you know, and interact and have just a more, intimate, vulnerable experience.
The lawsuit didn't specifically include distilleries, but at a recent Alaska Alcoholic Beverage Control Board meeting, board members said they believe those businesses will fall under the same ruling and be able to have unlimited live music as well. In Juneau, I'm Yvonne Cormery.
Beginning in July, Kenai Central High School junior Josh Bowling will have the ears of Alaska's top education officials as their student advisor.
Well, my role is to bring perspectives and thoughts of students around the state to the State Board of Education. And those can be to affect policy and like everything in the schools that affects students.
The 17-year-old already has some experience with leadership roles. For the last 2 years, he's held a similar position on the Kenai City Council, updating members on school events and the things on students' minds. And he was also selected by a group of fellow Kenai students to serve on the school district's Educational Material Review Committee. He says it's important for students to be involved, especially when it comes to education.
These policies and these rules and laws that are made by the school board and the Department of Education are what affect the students. It's what affects us every day in our school, in our environment. And I think it's important to remember that these politicians, they seem so big and scary, but, you know, in the end of the day, they're just adults.
Bowling says he'll advocate for further increases to the base amount of money the state gives school districts per student, and he's especially passionate about career and technical education. Bowling moved to the Central Peninsula when he was 10 years old. He's a baseball player and advanced placement student who owns a landscaping business. A Sitka-based cruise line is closing its doors. Alaskan Dream Cruises announced last week that it has ceased operations and canceled all future sailings. In a post on its website, the cruise company said since 2011, it's had the, quote, privilege of sharing the wonders of Alaska and the richness of our Alaska Native heritage with incredible guests from across the globe, end quote. The company is owned by Allen Marine, a local maritime business that's been offering wildlife and sightseeing tours in Southeast Alaska for about 5 decades. Here's company spokesperson Zach Kirkpatrick.
Really proud that we were homegrown and indigenous owned line right here in Sitka. And that grew into world-class cruises and winning national awards and appearing in worldwide publications, which was really something we're proud about.
Kirkpatrick says the decision to get out of the overnight cruise business was intentional and necessary for the sustainability of the company.
I think that, when you just kind of boil it down, the company just planning to refocus 100% of our resources on what we consider our founding strengths and roots, which are the day tour excursions and the shipyard operations and marine services.
Kirkpatrick says in 2025, Alaskan Dream Cruises employed 95 seasonal and about 10 year-round workers. The company said it's communicating with all guests about reservations and processing refunds. The Yukon Quest Alaska 750 got underway Saturday in Fairbanks. The sled dog teams have traveled many miles from Fairbanks by now, but KUAC's Patrick Gilchrist caught up with mushers and race officials Monday at Circle City and has this report.
Josie Shelley left Circle City a little after 2 p.m. on Monday afternoon, and she had a message on her way out for a fellow musher who was sleeping at the checkpoint.
Hell yeah, we better get up and get moving!
Jeff Dieter, the defending Quest champion, started preparing to head out of Circle about an hour later. How was his nap?
It was lovely. It's the first time I've slept on this race thus far.
And here's his response to hearing Shelley's parting message.
Yeah, I'm letting her lead this race. Last year, I basically led the whole 550. I said, well, I'm doing a different distance. Maybe I'll let someone else lead.
He says he's running some younger dogs in this year's race, and some who are a little less headstrong than last year's, so he's taking more rest.
I'm hoping to be able to, like, cut some rest later on in the race, but who knows? Right now, we're just trying to survive, so it's the Yukon Quest motto, I think. Survive until the finish.
We've just been running the dogs.
Shelley says her team is doing well, and that taking and keeping the lead hasn't been what she's thinking about the most.
Running my team how they need to be run, so not really too worried. There's a long way to go.
The Mushers have tackled two notorious summits, Rosebud and Eagle outside Central, as well as Deep Cold along the winding Birch Creek on the run from Central to Circle. Both Mushers say Rosebud was windblown and icy. Dieter says the top of Eagle Summit was nice, but that getting there was a challenge.
Pretty windy, some blizzard conditions. I had good visibility, but there was no discernible trail really to follow.
He says his hat goes off to Keaton Lobrick, who led Mushers through that stretch of the trail. Lobrick scratched late Sunday night at mile 101 in the best interest of his team, according to a Yukon Quest Alaska social media post. Race Marshal John Schandelmeyer says Lobrick had moved on from the checkpoint to Eagle Summit, but Schandelmeyer says Lobrick returned to mile 101 with a dog that had a tooth injury after getting into a fight with another dog. Schandelmeyer says Lobrick's team rested, then tried to head to Central once more before scratching.
They ran into the wind, turned around, ran back to the checkpoint, then turned around, went back out into the wind, and then they got up to this summit, and it was just a bit much for them, you know.
He says Lobrick returned to 101 again and decided not to continue in the race at that point. After departing Circle, Mushers will travel along the Yukon River to the next checkpoint at Fort Yukon, where there's a mandatory 8-hour rest. Schandelmeyer says it's set to be cold on the river, around 50 below, but that the trail itself is one of the easier parts of the race. He says it's flat, with little to no jumble ice, and not windy. Reporting from the Yukon Quest Trail and Circle, I'm Patrick Gilchrist.
At last check, Josie Shelley continued to lead the Yukon Quest Alaska 750, trailed by Jeff Dieter, Jonah Bacon, and Jason and Patrick Mackey. Well, the odds are good, but the goods are odd. It's a familiar joke in Alaska, and for some people trying to date here, it can feel painfully true. But with Valentine's Day just around the corner, is there a way to swing the odds of finding that special someone in your favor? For our Alaska Survival Kit series, Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early set out to learn how Alaskans can increase their chances of finding a date and falling in love.
It's about 14 degrees outside Anchorage's Magnetic North Brewing Company, but the vibe is much warmer inside. About a dozen people meet for a singles night. Josiah Smith, a single guy from the Kenai Peninsula, was part of a small group near the front of the brewery. I caught him as he walked into a larger room where people were mingling. He came to meet people in person instead of using a dating app, which he says can feel like playing an awkward game.
You have to come up with something catchy, and I can't do it. And I don't want to. It's like, if I say hello back, and I say, how are you doing? And then it's like, I'm blah, blah, blah from this place. And where are you from? And go from there.
Now, I haven't been single since I started dating my wife in 2019, but I've heard concerns like Josiah's from friends and colleagues. Dating in Alaska can be tough. So how do you make it easier? I spoke with experts and came back with four main takeaways. Josiah may not want to hear the first one. Don't snub the apps. That's from Marcia Shirak Olson. She's a communications professor at the University of Alaska Anchorage who's worked as a professional matchmaker. And she says dating apps might actually be for you. She says if you're on the dating app looking for something real, chances are there are others too. She calls it the gross bar example.
You walk into a kind of a dive bar and you're like, oh, it's kind of gross in here and everyone doesn't seem that great. But I'm here, and I'm pretty cool, and if I'm here, then maybe there's someone else like me who's here.
Marcia says many of her friends over the past 10 to 15 years have met their partners through dating apps. But if you're going to use them, she says you should be specific about what you're looking for and be authentic. In other words, takeaway two, be yourself.
If you are not outdoorsy and you don't hunt and fish, like if the only time you've ever been fishing is the time that you have that one photo from, like don't lean in that hard to that. Maybe disclose that this is my one fish.
But maybe you've been on the apps for a while and you really want to meet someone the old-fashioned way. That brings us to takeaway three, get out of the house. Marcia says socializing can mean going to singles events, but she says it can also mean just hanging out with your friends. It just has to be in public.
Going out and sitting and chit-chatting with your friends, that opens up your social circle. That means you could potentially meet more people. that brings your potential partner in. It also develops you into an interesting person because now you have friends and interests, and that's important because a good partner has interests. They have a life.
Finding a date in a city like Anchorage with tens of thousands of residents is one thing, but finding one in a smaller community is another, says Anchorage-based relationship therapist Amber Vile. She's lived in Alaska a long time, in communities big and small. More rural communities often have a much smaller dating pool, and it may be difficult to find the one. But Amber says you shouldn't let that stand in the way of making connections with people. So here's takeaway four. You can forget forever, for now.
I'm not sure I'm going to meet the person of my dreams. So can I pivot here and, like, have some fun? Can I just connect? Can I explore what it's like to, like, date a lot of different people or date nobody and date myself, right?
And if you're already in a relationship but want to keep the romance alive, I've got a bonus tip just for you. Amber says as relationships progress, couples can often get bogged down with lots of other things like careers, children, and the stresses of everyday life. She suggests couples do a Marriage Monday. Now, it doesn't have to be a Monday and you don't have to be married, but essentially it's time you've set specifically for you and your partner to come together, just the two of you.
You play, you mix it up, right? You take a class together, you read a book together, you're doing something that says, I'm turning towards you, you're all I see, I'm putting my phone down, I'm not working, let's go enjoy.
Right? Someone's watching the kids.
Yeah, get a babysitter, right?
Maybe that Marriage Monday can be on Valentine's Day. Personally, I'm going to try my hand at French cooking for my wife. Now, I've never made a sauce from scratch or seared a steak with peppercorns, but I'm hoping it'll be a nice restaurant-quality meal we can share at home. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
And that is all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Aliona Niden and Wesley Early in Anchorage, Samantha Watson in Bethel, Yvonne Crumry in Juneau, Ashlyn O'Hara in Kenai, Hope McKinney in Sitka, and Patrick Gilchrist in Circle City. Our audio engineer is Crystal Hyde, Kirsten Dobroth is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.